Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So today I'd like to introduce Rob Hadley, who's an independent research consultant who has conducted research with both the Open University and Manchester Metropolitan University, where he's an associate lecturer. He's also a counsellor and he's the author of Male Childlessness. I can see that's going to happen a few times during the course of this, as well as numerous book chapters and journal articles on this theme. And I believe you're also a founding member of Aging Without Children.
That's correct, yeah.
So voluntary childlessness in men might not at first seem our usual choice of subject for this podcast. However, I heard Rob speak at a Psychology of Men conference a few years ago and thought there were two aspects of his research that would be really interesting to spend time reflecting on with him, which have direct relevance to working clinically in prisons. So the first of these themes, Rob, is the most obvious one, is the theme of involuntary childlessness. And for those men in the high secure estate who aren't already fathers when they come to prison, they're likely to spend the period of life most associated with reproductive success inside and possibly miss the boat altogether. And the other thing I found really interesting about your research was that you've written about the absence of consideration of men being interviewed by those who are not like them. And again, I thought this theme could be worthy of us exploring today. So really delighted that you were willing to come on and have a conversation in an area that might not be your usual niche sort of area. So welcome.
Well, thank you. And it's going to be a really interesting discussion. It's always good to be challenged.
Good. Well, I have to say, Rob, that I'm really grateful to you for introducing me to this subject, because despite the fact that I've worked with men all my life, I've barely thought about this at all until Naomi mentioned your name and your subject a few weeks back. So to continue, we hear a lot about involuntary childness in women in the media, and I think there's some appreciation that lack of choice about parenthood is really painful for women. But it's rare to hear discussion about what it's like for men. Is that because they're not so bothered?
That's a narrative that's associated with men and pushed onto them. So no, I disagree with that. Men are bothered, very much bothered, but there's not the social narrative for them to occupy or invest in as there is with women. Most societies are pronatalist. They've got an invested interest in reproducing, but that tends to be focused solely on the women as mothers. And from a feminine's perspective, the motherhood mandate could be seen as a burden, always being judged by your reproductive capacity. And if you don't reproduce, is that because you're being selfish, because you're career-minded, or is it a sympathy that you've lost out on this highly valued status? And I think in all societies, becoming a parent is highly valued and a marker of a mature adult and achieving that status level. If we look across to men, and masculinities, virility is very strong, and being a provider, protector, and they're rewarded and acknowledged. But actually, yeah, becoming a father, very big thing, but it's almost like, yeah, that's it. And there's no narrative around not becoming a father, whereas there's lots of narrative around not becoming a mother.
Yeah, that's a good point. And certainly when I think, because obviously when I've been talking to men about children, it's usually been in some pretty uncomfortable circumstances, like separating from a partner, fighting over children, or more often in prison, men pining for the children that they can't see. But there's a kind of absence, an absence of discussion or thought about childlessness. And I wonder if that's something which people are scared to stand out in some way as being without children.
I think especially for men, a lot of the work around childlessness is from infertility studies. And a lot of the work around infertility is on the woman's body. And that process that she has to go through is very involved and involved with the medical side of things. The men in a similar situation often feel excluded because they're only there for one thing, and that's to provide a sample. A lot of the research therefore reflects that relationship between the woman and the institutions.
What you've made me think about whilst you're talking just there is about potency and the tremendous place that potency is supposed to play in our culture. I mean, it enters into many of our films and certainly literature, classical and modern literature, the strength of the man, often depending upon the kind of what's the word for it, the quality of the sperm count, to put it crudely.
Absolutely. We aren't raised or educated to question our fertility, and it only becomes a question when you don't fulfill the societal norm. And so a lot of the men I spoke to said there's a thing called, in the arc of life, there's expectations of what you'll get to. And all the men said, you know, I expect to leave school, get a job, get married, or find a partner, have children, become a family. And that's where it ends. And if you're middle class, leave school, go to university. And then that, and when people do those things, but then get to the family part and their peers are producing, let's say in their 20s and 30s, and you're not, then there's something missing there. And you realize actually, or you feel off track and outside, and people, and there's a social clock element. And social expectations. So parents might say, you know, when we're going to hear the patter of tiny feet? When am I going to become a grandparent? Now, so there's a social pressure along our peers and culturally as well. And if you're not hitting that, where are you? And timing is really important when it comes to fertility outcomes. And what I found in my research was around about the age of 35, men were particularly broody. And they were broody, I think, because they didn't want to be old fathers. They want to be fathers who can go through the milestones of playing football, taking their child to the prom, to university, first job, first home, all those sort of things, but being physical capable of doing that. And for some reason they seem to associate the age over 50 of then becoming a time of decline and frailty. So 35 was really a key point of actually the clock's ticking, because in 20 years time I'm going to be a bit frail, I might not be able to do this is it. But I think also there is a biological aspect in that sperm starts to decline in efficiency around about the age of 35. So in that way, it sort of matches the woman's biological clock as well, because again, 35 is a critical age. The difference being that the menopause and change of hormones is quite different to the male one, which is a slow decline. However, the sperm starts to fail and reduce in efficiency over lifetime. So one of the myths around men is that they're fertile from puberty till death. And it's technically true, but there's a social aspect against that. So in some of my research, I found there's only like 2% of registered people, men who are registered fathers, age 50 and above. So there's a social aspect and there's a biological aspect as well on that. And on your previous question, there was something missing, and there is something missing, and the men feel this, that there's something missing from their lives, and that is that norm, not achieving that norm that everybody else seems to be very, very easily achieving. But it's also missing in the social narrative and missing in the statistics. So the narratives that the women can occupy is different to the ones that men can't. And so quite often men would say there's something missing. And that's a real key phrase, because what's missing are the words for them to occupy, to express themselves. So it's a felt missing, but it's a social missing as well.
It's really absent in people's minds within society. I remember I was a geriatric mum at 41, and I remember being sat with my son having a coffee at a cafe, and two boys passed, and they must have been about age 10, say, and they both stopped to coo in adoration at my son. And I remember being quite shocked at that experience, and it shouldn't really shock me, but it's that sense of females are more interested in children and offspring than males are. You know, that can be the only explanation for it, really. But I think that lack of mindfulness of the fact it's also a relevant factor for men may mean that we're also neglecting opportunities where we should be allowing people the chance to speak of that and acknowledge the difficulty. So as you're aware, we're really interested in well-being and resilience and barriers to these. And for many men serving long prison sentences during their late 20s to mid 40s, their chances of fathering children are probably going to be extremely limited. They weren't already fathers when they came to prison or to secure hospital. Might have lost their chance. And yet this isn't something that's spoken of at all, I think, really, in prisons or secure services. Do you think there's an emotional toll to involuntary childlessness that we might be neglecting to acknowledge in treatment?
I do, because as Dave pointed out, not many people associate men not reproducing as an emotional impact on them. And it's a disenfranchised grief. It's not acknowledged in society. There's no narratives there. There's no rituals around it. And in fact, you've almost pointed it out yourself. Men being emotional and cooing is frowned upon. That's not what men are supposed to do. And I think David Morgan said something like, in sociology, the humanities, we looked at men as mankind, not as people. And so they're sort of measured by things outside themselves, how they behave, what their economic status is, how they do the provider protector role, but it's all sort of outside them. The question isn't, you know, men behave this way because, and so there's an investigation into the because. It's often why, and that's quite a defensive position to be asking why rather than because. I think because leads to an understanding. I think for many societies, men from an early age are socialized out of acknowledging their feelings and what's happening inside. But also the whole society supports that. I find it really interesting, you know, sperm is the only cell that can survive for any length of time outside the body. Things associated with men are their potency outside the body. So it's like what their body will deliver in terms of provider protector role. So there's an existential virility there. And is that the difference between men and women? That women are defined by their virility internally, that motherhood mandate, and men outside. And what happens when you don't fulfill that mandate, that's a societal mandate that you've been brought up with as an expectation, you will become a father, you will become a mother, unless something comes up where that's questioned quite early on in life for some reason. So yeah, I think it is missing, and men and women are really interested in this subject, and they will say, but it's sort of obvious men are broody and want to reproduce. And I would say, you know, if we went off planet and there's a species, let's say Mars, let's say the Mars, what's it called? Anyway, the device finds two species, a male and a female, there. If either one of those doesn't want to reproduce, that species isn't going to survive. If we come back down to Earth, I'd say, if I say the name Lucy, people know what I'm talking about. But where's Len? Lucy's 50%. But where's the male side of that? And that seems to have carried on. If you look at Facebook and look at what age boys are referred to as my little man, my little soldier. And sometimes it can be really like 6 months or something like that. And what is the implications of how that kid's raised? And that cuts across all sorts of characteristics of class around that. And if you compare it to similar girls, you won't see my little woman, but you might see my little princess. And these things stick. So I think there's an internalization of that socialization. I'm sure I've read somewhere, we're born with the same emotional capacity as human beings. So something happens to block for men not to be emotionally expressive.
Yeah.
And when they do express themselves, it's usually by action and goal oriented. So when I was counseling, this thing, it's like a block here, just under the chin, going down top of the rib cage of concrete that's being placed there. And what men, I soon learned not to say to men, tell me what you're feeling, because there'd just be a silence and a puzzled look. And you could see the cogs whirring. How am I going to access what I'm feeling? And there's a couple of things about that. Actually, how am I going to make it safe for the other person? What's suitable to say? And I think that's why when it comes to therapy, what works for men is quite often activity-based. So painting, poetry, gardening, men in sheds. And again, that's things outside that helps the process. So you create something outside yourself, but then you can work in. Glenn Poole, who ran a thing in Bournemouth about men and suicide, found that the way of working and it works very well for women, is you work on the inside out, you work where your feelings go out. But for men, that didn't work. And actually, it was much better to work from the outside in and hope it comes in. So if a man was saying, look, I'm really, really suicidal, everything's gone wrong. Okay, what's the biggest thing? I've lost my job. I'm not a provider. Okay, what can we do about that? How can we do this? And then resolve it and work in.
You raised a really interesting theme there, because men are definitely in the minority amongst psychologists or psychological therapists in forensic hospitals and prisons. And, you know, I wondered about what impact this might play in developing appropriate treatment, and if you had any thoughts on this, and whether there are any lessons from your research on that.
Interviewing men, I found there's a lot of material about women and women researchers interviewing men and the issues that they faced of being viewed as a sexual target, for want of a better word, sexualization within the interview. But then there was another narrative coming from some researchers, and actually particularly fathers were saying, this is the first time I've spoken about this. There's nothing out there for me. It's the first time somebody's listened to me. And they were very moved by the emotions that actually the fathers had nobody to listen to them. And for me, what I put out there very quickly was, I'm a man who was desperate to be a dad. Well, I wanted to be a dad and didn't become one. I wanted to interview men like me. And my wording of dad, not father, wanted to be rather involuntary childless. And I was trying to use words that people use in the everyday and how they'd see themselves rather than clinical terms. And all the men that contacted me said very soon in the first contact, do you have children? And I had a nice little phrase that said, no, I don't. And that's why I became interested in this. There's so little about men like us who don't, who want to be dads and didn't become them. And I've done a little bit of research on this. So I want to get across that I was like them, but also I was doing it for research. And then the focus was back on them. So a little bit about me to establish that shared ground. And again, the shared ground is outside. It's an experience, but it's something that connects us, but it's between us. And I think that was crucial, really, in getting the long interviews I had with the men. And I think they're always sort of testing you a bit to make sure you're following them. And men aren't really used to being listened to. And once you've gained their trust, they will talk and tell you a lot of things. But gaining that trust, I think, is a bit harder work than working generally with women. We're talking broadly here. I think also there's a resistance in some communities about men occupying this reproductive realm. So Marcia Inhorn in America, I think at MIT, she says men are the second sex in reproduction, partly because of this theory that men aren't interested and therefore aren't bothered, when there's no evidence for that.
I think it's so interesting because I think there's a big drive in services that are aimed at women for people to have the choice of having a female therapist, and yet that never really gets spoken of in relation to men. And then so many of the staff that are devising treatment for men are women. So one of my male colleagues went on training for delivering, I think it's called healthy sexual functioning, something like that. But it was concerned around male sexuality anyway. And he said he felt really affronted that these two women were talking to him about male sexuality and imposing their views as women and their perceptions of male sexuality on him. And it wasn't possible to question or challenge, even though they were talking about male sexuality, which, you know, if the roles were reversed, people would be quite affronted at men talking to women about how they should express their sexuality.
I think linking to that is something around who's it for, that quite often some of the therapies for men are actually for the benefit of women. So making men fit what's good for their partner, actually not what's good for them. So men as partners, not men as people. So men in the roles, but not as humans feeling messiness.
And again, related to that theme around men and women, I suppose, you know, just so conscious of how many of the mental health staff working in these places are young women of childbearing age. And often in forensic settings, when staff become pregnant, they're removed from face-to-face contact in order to reduce or manage the risk. There are services like the service that I work for at the Fens, where clinical staff have continued to work there even right fully. I did face-to-face contact throughout my pregnancy, and I know that evoked all sorts of strong feelings in the men. But I wondered, what impact do you think it might have on the men to be faced with pregnant women when they've perhaps not seen them for over a decade, or alternatively to hear they've been whisked away from the service because they're pregnant and then not really have the opportunity to resolve those feelings?
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because as fitting in with the protector provider role, and also maybe using that situation to access those deep things within men of what it would be like to be a father. It's interesting that in a lot of just coming through in health service around the perinatal period, the pre-birth and just after birth, the lack of information for fathers. So I did a study with Sarah Earle at the OU looking at father's influence on breastfeeding. And one of the things that came through was the father saying, there's nothing for us. One father said, when it became to the pre-birth training, we were sent away from the breastfeeding module. And yet, support for the mother and the child, the father and the intimate family are going to really be there. And a lot of the fathers were annoyed that they couldn't find anything, and they were ignored or pushed away by the staff. And I think maybe also from the staff side, they've had no training in that. And if the training just reinforces norms, then it could be a bit strange for this father to be asking, well, how do I help with the breastfeeding? Mm-hmm. And it's just coming back to you, actually, I'm not sure. So it's not uncommon to blame the victim a bit. And I think that happens in therapy when, you know, that person wasn't ready for therapy. Maybe the therapy wasn't ready for them.
Yeah, it could be influenced by the maturity of the person delivering it, can't it?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, yeah, that's really interesting about facing somebody who's fertile, and that might be your ambition. It's there in front of you, and it's a reminder of what you're not.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I think it led to all sorts of really strong feelings. So I think there was the sadness about their own lack of fulfilled potential as fathers. I think there was also and jealousy. And then also, because obviously sexualized feelings can come into the relationship as well. So jealousy that you're pregnant and it's not their child, but also jealousy because they experience you as being a good mother in therapy, and that's something they've not had. And so jealousy of the developing baby also. So really complicated opportunities for really complex kind of work. I don't know if you've experienced, David.
Sorry, I didn't hear that, Naomi.
I didn't know if that was your experience of female staff being pregnant in the services that you've worked in.
Yeah, often managers got very alarmed about that and wanted to keep them away, yes. Mm. But it seems to me that, Rob, that what you're doing is drawing attention to the intensity of the intimate, which men are often steered away from or shy away from. There's often a kind of, not quite sure the right words to use, vengeful attack upon the role of the female arising from this. And I'm reminded of, there's a phrase in the Aresia by Aeschylus, where Apollo describes women as pods. So women are just pods who carry the male's baby, really. And that, I mean, it's part of a debate, so it's not the position of Aeschylus, but it's part of the debate that happens within this play. And it seems to me that that kind of argument has gone on, well, for millennia, really.
Absolutely. I think there was, I'm assuming he's a Greek philosopher, those early philosophers were very much, women were nature. And you still actually see this in adverts, like shampoo adverts. Usually there's a woman running through a field of flowers, and it's very much tied in. Aren't women natural and beautiful, and everything's going to be just so? And obviously women actually suffer from this a bit when they do give birth, because the expectation is they'll be a natural mother and things will just be so. And the reality is quite different. We do have to learn to be parents, I think, even though obviously I'm not one. And it came to me about philosophy. There's a feminist, who can't remember who said, you know, all these men talking about women and placing them really outside of reproduction earlier. And then as science came in, trying to manipulate women back in. But actually, if you're looking at peering over the edge at creation, all the men, all those male philosophies are on the outside of that bubbling cauldron of creation. And does that really mean creation is women?
Hmm.
Gosh, we got into that deep philosophy thing where we should be drinking wine and eating cheese.
Those were the days. Yes.
Yeah. I'm just going to go, a couple of friends, well, ex-colleagues of mine were successful in academia. They were doing really well. And they got in contact with me a couple of years ago, both of them separately. And they were in the, one was in the early 40s, the other one was in mid 40s. And they said, you know, we're doing all right. But there was something missing. So that term, this is what they put in their emails. There was something missing. When my partner became pregnant and I became a dad, that's when I realized that was a missing element. And that's what was part of my frustration.
Hmm.
Having their attention drawn to it as something to be able to articulate earlier, whereas for women, that idea that you need to aspire to have children is there kind of from the get-go, so you're perhaps much more given much more thought over to if there's a gap for you if you don't have a child, maybe.
And it's all around in the media around women and having babies or not having babies. So Kylie sort of defending one of many of actresses or famous people who defend not becoming a mother, but they have to defend it.
Definitely. Yeah.
For men, I don't think they do defend it in the same way, but maybe there's a slight actually... It's a bit strange he's not become a dad. And certainly I think for ordinary men, if such a category exists, then not becoming a dad, and certainly with age, I think men are seen as a threat more and more at any age as a threat. But as you get older, more of a threat of being a paedophile, of being a pervert, but also bizarrely, not being potent, mocked for impotence.
So men feeling left out is not uncommon, I think. Men often feel left out when their partners become pregnant and become preoccupied with the baby inside, and then you have the baby and garner all the attention. So we're often left having to cope with those complex and ambivalent feelings about childbirth. But one of the themes you raise is that of not belonging that crops up in relation to involuntary childlessness. Mm. So can you say a bit more about that specifically?
Yeah, you're not belonging. So society's pronatalist supports people with children. And not belonging, you're not within the alpha group, people who've achieved the norms, the expectations. So I'll go to when I was working and we're having a brew with two colleagues, and they both had kids around 7 and 8. And they were saying, oh, the kids were on DS. And I said, drug squad? The kids are playing drug squad. And that's what I said. Your kids are playing drug squad. Do you not think it's a bit early? And they sort of mocked me because DS are little computer things, aren't they? Well, apparently. And that, I think, actually, that's a difference. I don't know things around kids and all that sort of thing that they did. And their mockery of my ignorance was a way of not belonging. So not belonging to my peer group by not reproducing, by not having those social narratives, knowing what's going on. I think as an older man, we live on a street and there are kids on the street and you can see the kids going to each other's houses for parties and stuff like that. and we're excluded from that. We're not invited in. And the parents would say something, well, you don't want to go there, they're hell. But at the same time, when those kids are on the street, we've got to look after them as well as part of the neighborhood. So you belong to a community, but there's a not belonging as well. So you don't belong to that dominant group. And kids are great social bridges, formally and informally. And you're not.
So you use the phrase pronatalist.
Yeah.
I haven't come across that phrase before. What do you mean by it?
It means everything for children and reproduction. Yeah, it is a sociological term. So I guess you could say there's antinatalists, people who are against reproduction. But that's not very common. So quite often in the childless world, they'd say, you know, societies are pronatalist, and they are. There's benefits to becoming a parent. Time off work. If your child's ill, you might be able to leave work early, that sort of thing. Yes, and it is actually inbuilt. A guy I interviewed, he was living with a woman. They were in their mid-20s, and they worked in the NHS. I think she was a nurse, like a senior nurse. But when it came to holidays, like bank holidays, stuff like that, because they didn't have children, they were dropped down the list. Well, you don't have children, you can work bank holiday. And somebody I knew worked in the banks, and the banks used to do their holidays a year in advance, and absolutely that was in writing. If you don't have children, then you're not having the summer holidays, you're not having the Christmas breaks, you go out other times. So there is that's how pronatalist it can be. And I think Keir Starmer has been going on about family just recently, and a lot of childless organisers say, well, what about people who don't have family? And that's really important, actually, later on in life, because when it comes to social care in later life, all the policies predicated on you having adult children to look after you. Whether as an adult child or as a parent, you want that to happen, doesn't really matter, because when push comes to shove, the state is going to say, you're an adult child, what do you want us to do? What's mum or dad's preference? Can you look after them? Can you be an intermediary? Can you be an advocate for them? So if you're an older person who doesn't have children, the chances are, and something goes wrong, if everything's okay with you, fine, you're the same as an older person who's got children. If something goes wrong, then the chances are you're going to be institutionalized at an earlier stage, at a lower level, than somebody with children, because children become the intermediaries. And if you think of the Mid-Staffordshire scandal, mm-hmm. Who raised the issue? It was an adult child saying, this isn't right. Mm-hmm. In that setting, there would have been people without children. So who was advocating for them? Were they looked after better because maybe a member of staff or was there who took it on? Or were they just actually easily managed?
Good point. I think that that issue of not belonging is really pertinent and offending, because I think quite often that's been a significant factor in why certainly men have offended. So the men have often felt very marginalised and felt as if society has given up on them. So offending is sometimes being quite a dysfunctional way of saying fuck you to the world.
Yeah.
Belonging in an out-group who relate to each other through offending can also be significant, for instance, in kind of gang-related or extremist crimes.
Mm.
So I wonder, you know, when we're thinking about preparing people for taking their place back in society after being in prison for a long time, whether we ought to be thinking much more about talking about involuntary childlessness in terms of preparing people for what it's going to be like out there adjusting to the world if you've missed your, you know, if you're off time, as you say, and not likely to manage to hit a target around becoming a dad.
Yeah, it's I was really interested in four of the guys in my PhD who were grandfathers, but not biological grandfathers. So one guy had been approached. He was a big football fan of his local team. And a man with two sons sat behind him, approached him and said, "Luke, school needs doing a project on grandfathers. My dad's dead. Would you be a grandfather for this project?" And he said, "Yeah, sure, I love it." He was a gay man. He went, "You know, I'm left a gap." And the fellow said, "Yeah, it's fine, not a problem." And so he was grandfather for, I think, 3 years to these boys who were, I think, 10 and 12. And he said, it was great to have that connection. And they still see me now. And they say, "Hello, Gran, Dad, how are you doing? Down the match. How does that make you feel?" Makes me feel belonged, like I belong. Another gay man, his partner had died 10 years previously through a lung condition, and he was had suicidal ideation. He was depressed, anxious. And he said, "I had the tablets and the whiskey on the table, but I thought, no, it's like too easy to do this. So I'm going to go out." And there were a gay couple who didn't involve themselves in the gay community. And so he took a job in a local pub who had young children, and he became latent grandfather to them. So he babysat, he bought them birthday cards and Christmas cards, read to them. I couldn't say it. I think the husband would have been all right, but not the wife. I don't want to be seen as one of those fellas who's a paedophile, who's interested in kids just for other things. But I loved doing that and giving and being in that role. The other two types of grandfather, a chap had got seriously involved with a woman whose daughter became pregnant, and through a set of circumstances, he was actually a primary carer for like the first 2 months of the baby. Felt really bonded to this child, and so I treat her as if she was one of my own. And that's a big thing in my life. And another guy said, "I always wanted to be a dad." And then I was married for 30 years. We got divorced. I got with my wife, tried for children. He was in his mid-40s then. Didn't happen. Went for a check and found out I was infertile and probably had been since my teenage years. So that sort of put an end to that dream. But then my wife's niece became pregnant. She didn't have a dad. So as soon as I found that out, I said, "Can I be grandfather to this baby?" And so the call came about 6 hours later after the child had been born. I was in the hospital with this little baby cradling in his arms and looking down, said, "You know, if you're my child, I'd just do everything for you." So at that point, I really knew I'd always wanted to be a dad, but actually to have a sense of the bond between a parent and a child, that was a difference. And later he said, "You know, if I can see this surrogate granddaughter to 18, that'll be something." So there's something about then putting things in place. And then there's obviously a legacy of stories you can tell and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's something about the structures that's there so people can occupy the roles they expected to occupy or wanted to occupy. And I think there's something around the emotional drive that's denied, I think, through socialization or certainly through experience of early years relationships, that is maybe suppressed but comes out in different ways and maybe can be drawn out.
Really interesting. really heard the poignancy in those stories, actually. It was really touching to hear.
So we were struck, Rob, by the fact that all of your research participants were fearful of being viewed as paedophiles by virtue of their childlessness, and wondered if you could say a bit more about that.
Yeah, they all referenced it either directly. So a guy I interviewed, his partner had died 2 years earlier, and they had dogs, and the partner was a gatekeeper. They lived on a small street, and the kids came and played with the dogs, and it was very nice. But once his partner died, he wouldn't let them in. I don't want to be seen one of those guys with kids coming in the house. They knock on the door and I say, no, get your dad, get your mum. And then, so that was really direct. Other men said, well, I just got to be careful about being seen. And I think that's drawn, I think particularly since 2000, when I think the News of the World had that front page with six pictures of men, older men, saying, is he a paedophile on your street? I think it keys into a couple of things. Men seen as threats. So that's a denial of that emotional. Men can be loving, giving beings. And older men, particularly. Yeah, so they all mentioned it. So it's definitely an undercurrent there. And maybe it's something to do with education. In education, we're not really educated in how to be parents, how to interact with children until you actually become a parent, I think. And then you learn on the job, and you learn by joining that group of people who say, oh, this is how you can deal with this. This is how you can deal with that. But yes, they all mentioned that fear of being seen a paedophile. But I think there's some research on fathers as well that say fathers have that fear as well. So if there's a sleepover, they're very careful around policing themselves so they can't be accused of that. So there's something there in society that's viewing men and viewing them at their worst, I think, straight away.
Absolutely. I mean, I've certainly heard people say, oh, they'd never have a male babysitter, or they would never, you know, they wouldn't want one of the nursery staff to be male, make them question the person's motives. And you think, well, that just, you know, women also abuse, and yet there isn't, you know, there's this assumption that males must be something a bit dodgy or a bit sinister about them if they're in contact with young kids. And yet, actually, I think for many young kids, they don't have enough positive male role models in their life. They don't see enough of men behaving in ways that are caring towards them in a very obvious way.
It's really interesting, isn't it? I think there's a cultural aspect to that, because I think I remember in India and that those continents, there was more men who were primary school teachers than there were women.
That's interesting.
But here it's very much the reverse. I know there's a drive to get men in there. And I did interview for another project a man who was a primary school teacher. And he said, if a kid falls over in the playground, I call one of the women. Even if the instinct is to go and pick the child up. No. And he also said that was very direct from parents, that he must be a bit strange to be doing that job. There's something around, again, Julie Bruno did a recent book on miscarriage. And she contacted me, and she puts a section in about men because they're excluded from the grieving process. They're excluded from the whole process, and that they're just expected to get on with it.
My son's at primary school, and as a male teacher this year, and I was so delighted he got a male teacher, and then of course he's not in school, is he? So not getting the benefits.
It's a terribly difficult area, this, isn't it? And of course there's a tremendous fear about even opening up a debate about these things, because, you know, once you do that, you're treading into, you know, the kind of ground where yeah, some rag may identify you as being a paedophile yourself. And there is this tremendous social need, it seems, to identify other people as being bad and evil and those who interfere with children. I remember, and of course it's much more complex than that. I remember going to a lecture once at a hospital I was working with. It was given by somebody else called David Jones, who was a child psychiatrist. And the core of his argument was how much advertising is centered around little children, how children are used frequently as sexual objects in advertising to entice people, presumably men, to purchase things. And yet that's a forbidden area. Well, of course, Freud wrote about it, his polymorph for sexuality. And but the fact is, you know, that it's still a no-go area as far. Well, of course, you're opening up, so that's a jolly good thing. Just to follow on from my question, though, do you think that the anxiety about being identified as a paedophile may be heightened, may be exacerbated if you're already somebody with a criminal record, so you're already hiding something?
Absolutely. I think you've made that link, and it just seems so strikingly obvious that if you're viewed as a problem, it's very easy to load everything on there, to project all fears onto that site, that individual. That fella's a bit dodgy. If he's dodgy like that, why could well be dodgy in all these other areas I really don't want to rationalize or investigate, but have a strong feeling about. I'm just reminded now of, I gave a talk at a conference and sat down, and a lot of the places I've given talks, it's 99% women. Often I'm the only man, or there's only one other man. I think in this conference I was the only man there. And sat down, and I do the thing I always do. I sit at the front in the corner so the women can see where I am. And the next speaker came up, and then halfway through her talk, she said, "And the paedophile in the corner." It was just shocking to be identified. She had been resistant to me all the way through, because at the coffee at the reception thing, I said, how are you, what are you talking about? And she just turned her back on me. I think that's because I'm a man going into an area that's, for some people, is only for women. And they don't want men being associated with it. Reproduction is for women, and in feminisms, you know, reproduction, it's the best thing, it's the most feminist thing you can do, or ART, assisted reproductive technology, IVF, that's the most feminist thing you can do. There's a massive debate around reproduction, and it is core to feminisms, that motherhood mandate, not to be defined by your womb, by your capacity to reproduce. In masculinities, nothing much about that at all. A little bit about fatherhood, but nothing around what it's like not to be a father, to be childless. It's I find that really interesting. And I find the resistance to actually involving men in reproduction interesting as well. And what does that say? Has a society, how much have we changed? I mean, is it broad Guardian readers at the surface, but the default is to be very traditional?
So, Rob, it's been a really enjoyable interview, given us lots of really thought-provoking stuff to think about, but at the end, we always like to ask our guests to point us in the direction of something they've found enjoyable or nourishing to read, listen to, or watch, and wondered whether you might have anything valuable to share with our listeners.
Mm. That's such a good question. I enjoy the little things. I enjoy going in the garden and just planting stuff and seeing things grow. And I actually enjoy seeing and hearing the kids on the street. I do like the sound of kids. Actually, you know, our neighbour's got two kids. I think they're 5. And in the summer, at some point, they were just having a great time playing together. And I couldn't see them, could hear them. And it was so moving just to hear kids just being in the moment and expressing themselves. It was a beautiful thing. And I texted my neighbour saying, I just want you to know how much I enjoyed listening to your kids enjoy themselves. It was a beautiful moment. So I think that beauty in just the everyday things is...
That's really touching. That's brilliant. Thanks very much, Rob. Really great to have you on today.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks a lot, Rob. Good to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was really brilliant and really thought-provoking. Lots to reflect on afterwards.
Yeah.
That was interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah, fascinating bloke, really. Chilling, that last little anecdote that he gave us about being referred to as the paedophile in the corner.
Oh, I know. Just imagine if the genders or sexes were reversed in. And imagine how that would go down. But I also thought, you know, I thought it was really interesting, the hearing children, the noise of children playing and laughter outside, and how nourishing that was. And you could really see from Rob's face the nourishment that he got from that, which I think is something we can all relate to. So something feels a bit sad about the fact that for some people that doesn't feel possible because of the assumptions that other people might make in relation to them.
Yeah. I found that a very informative and challenging conversation that we had. This left me feeling very thoughtful, slightly deflated, and I need to reflect about why that is. I think it's partly because of that last anecdote, which, of course, I know that if someone had said that in a prison, that could lead to somebody being beaten up or even killed, really. It's amazing how these things can be said seemingly without due consideration.
So next week's guest is Justin Wiggin. Justin is an award-winning sound artist who uses sound to enrich environments and help alleviate distress. Really excited to be interviewing him, as he always has some new innovation up his sleeve. So be sure to listen out for him.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.